And finally, oops, going the wrong direction. Just to set up this call, our moderator is Martha Cameron from the International Community of Women Living with HIV North America. And we have two wonderful presenters, Kendra Albert and Kay Greenberg, who will introduce themselves when they begin their talks. I'm going to now step behind the scenes and turn the show over to our moderator, Martha. Thank you so much for being here, Martha, and for moderating this call.
Oh, I am so excited, Jim. I mean, what a timely conversation in these crazy times that we are facing. And we are so privileged to have these special presenters for us, especially coming off of HIANC. Some of you may have been at HIANC. I was privileged to be in a session where Kay, was sharing some other information related to returning citizens and data and so on. So you're in for a very, very, very special treat. I do want to just mention that the information that is being shared today is kind of in a US context. I believe we have an international audience today. And so, but that doesn't mean that, we do not know and understand that there's surveillance and other data things going on all around the world right now. And so, without much further ado, I'd love us to get into this conversation right away. And I will ask Kendra if they could go first.
Sure. Thank you so much, Martha and Jim, and all the folks who've made this happen behind the scenes. I'm going to just make sure my slides are working. Really excited to be here with y'all today. The topic is certainly super timely, and I know everyone is, with everything being on fire, there's so much competing for folks' attention. So grateful that folks could join us today. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my background. We were joking before the webinar that I'm not going to do the 20-minute bio of where I was born and my favorite color in high school, but just enough to give you a sense of kind of what brings me to this work and sort of my background and experiences. And then I'm going to sort of focus on giving a bunch of high-level thoughts about kind of how do we think about data and risk around data, specifically in the context of people living with HIV, and then give us a sort of example to kind of think through about something that's happening in the current US context about sort of data sharing, which I think can sort of illustrate some of the risks that folks living with HIV and advocates have been sort of flagging for a very long time that I think are kind of being realized in new, I don't want to say exciting, new and momentous ways now. So just the brief about me. It's always weird to put up a headshot of yourself at the same time that like you're literally talking, but I don't know what else to put on the slide. So here we are. So I'm a public interest technology and media lawyer. Right now I run a teeny law firm that does sort of public interest technology and media law, sort of a little bit of everything in terms of working with questions that folks who are using technology to fight for justice and questions that arise from novel technologies. My previous job was I spent 7 years teaching at the Harvard Law School Cyber Law Clinic, where I worked with pro bono clients and with law students teaching them how to practice law. And sort of my background that brought me to the two conversations about and with folks with living with HIV is bodily autonomy work, specifically sex worker rights and repro, often with a focus on kind of First Amendment and speech issues, although certainly, cybersecurity and data privacy are something I've done plenty of. And some of the other stuff that sort of brings me here is I'm also a board member of the Tor Project, which is a human rights nonprofit that builds software to help people browse the internet anonymously, and a former board member of the ACLU of Massachusetts. So I want to think about sort of a little bit about sort of what I think, when Kay and Kelly and many of the folks who started putting together this webinar, and I started talking, sort of some of the stuff that was kind of on our minds, that sort of led to us thinking that this was a moment where we wanted to kind of maybe do some level setting and baseline conversations about kind of how to think about data in the snowballing surveillance state. And that makes me think a little bit about something that folks who are following US politics might remember from back in March, which feels like truly eternity ago, which was a presidential order say on stopping waste, fraud, and abuse by eliminating information silos. And sort of this is a headline that sort of summarizes what that was supposed to do, which is ordering full access to agency data for designated officials. So this was presented in the context of DOGE, which is sort of Elon Musk's attempt to streamline the federal government by making it work worse and not disobeying all the rules, would be my personal gloss on the subject. But the sort of broader what this executive order said is sort of that it had this goal of eliminating all of these restrictions on how data was used within the federal government. And to be fair, there are a lot of them, parts of, I think, sometimes folks have concerns about how, the US federal government sort of operates and everyone's kind of doing their own thing. But, a lot of that stems from very real efforts to be careful about sort of the degree to which the government is able to collect data and to legally require the collection of data. So, sort of what I feel like happened after the kind of information silo executive order was there was like a series of questions that I would generally say I would put into the category of can they do that? Right? The federal government demands data from Snap, but says nothing about protecting it. This is a headline from EFF in June. The USPS, so the Postal Service law enforcement assists Trump's mass deportation effort, sources and records show. So this is sort of using postal mail information and postal records, to sort of drive deportation. And then sort of the one I'll actually spend a fair amount of time talking about is this more recent article from the Philadelphia Inquirer talking about the Trump administration's use of personal giving of personal data on immigrant Medicaid enrollees to deportation officials. So there was sort of, I think, this set of questions at, about like are they allowed to do that, right? Both under this kind of the focus on the executive order eliminating information silos, but also sort of these broad programs of data collection, and what that means for the role of data collection from states, from individuals, from researchers. The short answer to the can they do that is there's a lot of litigation that is sort of trying to figure out the answer to that. This is just a subsection of those cases. Include things on employee data, cases on food stamp data. I suspect we'll actually get a case on the Medicaid data probably relatively soon. I don't think there's been one filed yet, although it's easy to miss such things given all that's going on. But more broadly, I think the question here that we sort of wanted to tee up for today is like, what does this mean about the personal information for folks living with HIV, including HIV status info and including molecular surveillance? And with that, I want to kind of take a step back and talk about sort of three kind of ideas, which is like, what kinds of data get collected? What are the tools that folks use to protect that data? And then how this corresponds to kind of different types of risk. And this is the part where, although I'm a US lawyer and, I focus primarily on the US, I think the broad structure of what I'm about to talk about is actually applicable, an applicable set of questions to many, many contexts in which we're thinking about how folks are engaging with data or thinking about collecting data. So when we think about sort of the types of data that, might get collected on folks with HIV, living with HIV in particular, there's a long list. But parts of what I think about in the context of health data are things like very straightforward stuff like electronic health. Okay, a universe of data. All right. So folks who people living with HIV, like pretty much everybody, have to the extent that they're engaging with the healthcare system, have electronic health records that track things, test results, doctor's visits, notes about them as patients, et cetera. There's also sort of claim data, to the extent that you're going through an insurer, either like Medicaid or a private insurer, information about kind of the Medicaid stuff that you're seeing. Sorry, I'm a little bit thrown off, so I'm going to do my best to kind of get back on track, but it may take me a second. So, basically, information about that are, how health insurance is categorizing data. Then there's also state level public health organization data. So this is something I think folks in these communities have talked a lot. And the context here is that both in terms of HIV testing, but also in terms of more broadly collection of information about individuals at the public health data level. There's also, of course, things like pharmacy data, right? If you're using a private pharmacy, they also have information about your health. And of course, in the context of HIV in particular, we have the CDC's HIV surveillance system data, and I'll talk about that a little bit more, as well as potential molecular health surveillance data. And I think Kay is definitely much more expert on that than I am, so I'll let him sort of take any questions on that in particular. Of course, there's also the reality that health data doesn't exist in a vacuum. Not just that it's not only held by healthcare providers. There's plenty of, other companies or other organizations that hold data about health for people. But also, data that's not related to one's health that potentially creates risk. So when we think about data, there's a lot of different sources, and generally people divide it into the categories of kind of identifiable and non-identifiable, de-identified data. So just as an example, identifiable data, very straightforward, is sort of Medicaid data, right? It has names, has addresses, has social security numbers, if folks have them, and it's claim data for enrollees. So it's pretty hard to get more personal and identifiable than that, right? Of course. But oftentimes we're also hearing things about de-identified data. So for example, CDC diagnosis data, sex, gender, which this includes things like sex, gender, race and ethnicity, age, transmission category, and the location of testing, right? So potentially state or metropolitan statistical area. Now, I think there are many folks on this call know this, but just to make sure that I set the baseline expectation, the idea that data is de-identified is often, I think, a risky way to think about it, because the reality is whether data can be re-identified, sort of paired back with individuals, is always contextually specific. It depends on things like how many folks were, matched the same criteria, had the same sex and gender, race and ethnicity, were in a particular transmission category in a particular location. It also depends on the technology available. So, this is sort of over time, there have been developments in technology, specifically usually in tools like machine learning or certain kinds of algorithms that make it much easier to sort of pair data sets together and re-identify them. That means that when we talk about de-identified data, I always think of it with this asterisk, right? Which is that there's always it is always pot often potentially re-identifiable under the right circumstances, and that means that there's always some amount of risk that comes from assuming that that data cannot be matched to individual people. Now, sometimes that risk is potentially useful or worth it, right? Like, this is not to suggest that no one should ever collect any data because it can be re-identified. But I think we're, on some level, in the absence of certain kinds of very specific technical guarantees, which are probably outside the scope of this webinar, but we need to be cautious about sort of assuming that de-identifying data once or removing certain types of information removes all risk associated with it. And to be asking questions about, okay, what's the long-term plan for this data that we're collecting so that we're not assuming that de-identifying it once de-identifies it in future circumstances. All right. So then the next thing I want to talk about briefly, well, it's not going to be that brief, but I'll do my best, is what kinds of protections are available. This is why I love the webinar title, Fighting for Firewalls, because firewalls often actually refer to multiple different types of protection that's available for data. So there's three primary ones I want to talk about here. And I'll go into all of these in a little bit more detail, but the three ways I would sort of divide up how we protect data are technical protections, legal protections, and sort of what I would call policy protections. So I'm going to talk first about technical protections because I think that's often what folks focus on, or often, not like focus on is maybe a strong word, but how folks explain the types of protections that are available, that and, well, So when we talk about technical protections, I think it's worth dividing these into sort of like a couple of different categories. So the best technical protection, frankly, for not having to turn over data or not having it used against people is to not have data in the first place. I felt so strongly about it, I wrote it twice. Right? You know, that like that the goal here is to make sure that, you know, you can't, you know, this often we say when we talk about subpoena response, you can't turn over what you don't have, right? And especially in an environment where there is a legal expectation of data sharing or turning it over, you know, not having access to certain forms of data is often the best kind of technical protection. But beyond that, there's sort of what I would call strong protection, which is kind of to say, you know, encryption is often an example here. How I would talk about it is math says they can't get this data. You know, it's secure because math, right? Now, of course, this is worth sort of flagging that the way that this works is not that because data is encrypted, no bad person will ever get to it. You have to ask who holds the keys to that data, who is able to sort of access it. And this gets into this point that technical protections are only as good as the sort of model for who they're built against, right? So just thinking about how strong protections can be really valuable, you know, so if you've ever heard folks talk about Signal, the messaging tool, you know, Signal does not have access to your messages. That's the promise of end-to-end encryption. So from a technical protection standpoint versus Signal, your messages are secure. But it doesn't mean that, you know, your conversational partner might not turn them over to somebody or have access to it. Then there's also sort of what I would consider weaker technical protections, right? Which is to say that it can be technically difficult to get or use the data. So to folks, sometimes I think kind of poo-poo this, and I think there are risks to kind of thinking about this as how you're protecting things. But frankly, like the fact that sometimes data is very difficult to sort of understand or kind of apply can form a way of protecting people against certain forms of risk because, you know, one thing that I feel like I often find myself saying is that, you know, when we're talking about certain forms of criminalization, like it's, you know, at least I would say maybe let's not go with a truth universally acknowledged, but an often acknowledged truth that law enforcement is lazy. And so the technical protections for data, that even ones that are weaker, like just making it harder for data to be used, can be effective. Again, right, like the point here is that these technical protections protect against particular people or particular organizations. They have what we would call a threat model. That means they're not going to necessarily be good against everyone. And often, within the context of certain kinds of healthcare data, these are aimed at outside adversaries, right? So evil hackers, not inside data sharing. We assume that if someone gets access to the data from the inside, that's okay. Of course, there's also legal protections, right? So, for our folks who are not from the US, I will note just as a really, yeah, I see in chat that someone flagged that we got the ruling in Skrmetti, which I think Kay and I have flagged as something we were thinking might happen today. I think we probably won't be engaging with it too much because neither Kay or I have obviously had an opportunity to read it, but I just want to acknowledge that. So for folks not in the US, it's important to note that there's no baseline data privacy law in the US that covers all data. This is something that I think folks can find surprising. We often have sectoral protection. So, you know, healthcare data or video rental data have their own protections. And many states have privacy protection laws, but there's no federal law that cuts across everything. You know, there are certain laws that prohibit sharing of types of data, especially when, you know, people have made or organizations have made representations that they're not going to share data. And there's laws that restrict data use, especially in the context of the federal government. You know, you may have heard folks talk about IRS data and restrictions on IRS data usage for criminalization. That's an example of a law that restricts data use. There's also procedural hurdles for certain kinds of government data sharing. So the big example here is the Privacy Act. And this is a legal protection, but in some ways, it sort of only protects against people who don't go through the appropriate process. And finally, I will note this. I think Kay's also going to talk about this. You know, when we're talking about healthcare data, I think there's this, you know, there is law that protects healthcare data in the United States. It's HIPAA. And it's not the answer to everything. First of all, to the extent we're talking about criminalization or risk from sort of law enforcement, Law enforcement can get access to healthcare data with appropriate legal process. There's no sort of, that is allowed under HIPAA. Additionally, HIPAA only covers health data that's held by healthcare providers. So to the extent that we think about data, certain kinds of data sharing, which I think we'll talk about, that doesn't necessarily help. The final category of protections that I want to just talk about is policy protections. And I know that I think I'm a little over time, so I'm gonna speed it up a teeny bit. Basically, policy protections is often what you hear cited if you're having conversations around sort of, oh, what's going to protect this thing? They're sort of often a reliance on informal expectations and practices. We've always done it this way. We've always required these particular things. Policy can also take the form of things like, in the US government context, agency regulations and guidance. Now, some regulations, of course, like have the force of law, but the reason I put them under policy is because they're often quite a bit more malleable and easier to adjust, right, than sort of the kinds of formal legal protections that might come from law passed by a legislature. That also sometimes gives us, I think, room to maneuver and potentially advocate, which Kay will talk about a little bit in the data policy context. All right. So we talked a little bit about the different types of protections that are available, and I want to talk a bit about the types of risk that might be things that we want to address. So, part of what I think is so difficult about talking about this space currently is just the amount of uncertainty that I think all of us, even folks with a lot of expertise, have about what the sort of level of risk we should be preparing for is, right? That it's difficult to assess in our current environment what feels like something that's totally off the table versus, oh, actually, this is something we should be thinking about. But the way I think I would personally describe it, and again, I'm trying to think about it in the context of folks living with HIV, is sort of distinguishing between kind of risks around individual identification. So this is questions like, does this person have HIV, or who is the person that got this HIV diagnosis? Which of course can result in criminalization, discrimination, denial of care, like have potentially tremendous and really significant consequences. But also distinguishing that from collective identification and sorting, right? So this might be something like matching data sets to each other in order to produce a list of all Medicaid recipients with HIV, for example. And this is, I think, it's a different type of risk because it speaks to kind of actions against a class of folks. And the sort of types of data that we would think about as risky and the sort of ways we would analyze those data or think about protections on some level is going to be different, right? It's difficult to understand in our current environment sort of whether these things are kind of likely outcomes. I think we haven't seen a ton of specific kind of usage of healthcare data for some of these collective identification and sorting on a federal level in specifically in a lot of contexts. But it isn't, I think it's harder to suggest that it's off the table in a way that would have been true 6 months to a year ago. But there are other types of risks as well. So we've talked about sort of, I think in the context of molecular surveillance, right, transmission patterns, right, sort of being able to tell things about people's lives, their experiences, their connections based on the sort of degree, the ways in which transmission happens. And of course, like obviously, but I'm going to say it anyway, right, people living with HIV have other identities. And, to the extent that we're talking a lot of, I'm going to talk a lot about immigration and deportation. Many folks living with HIV, may be undocumented, may not be citizens. And so all of these sort of forms of data risk are compounded by the kinds of other identities folks hold. So let's talk a little bit about kind of how this looks in practice. I talked at the beginning a little bit about kind of how there was this from a couple of weeks ago. An example of how sort of CMS in the US shared Medicaid data with DHS, which is a Department of Homeland Security. So CMS is Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in order to sort of, I think, on some level, help with deportations. So I'm going to talk a little bit in practice about what this means about kind of how we think about these protections. So as a baseline, right, what data do we have, right? Well, states have Medicaid records, including addresses, names, Social Security numbers, folks have them, and claim data for enrollees. And back, I think it was a couple months ago, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services requests claim data from California, Washington, from a series of states. I'm not going to read all of them, to determine if federal funds are providing Medicaid to non-citizens. So, they sort of send this request to the states and ask for this more specific data. Some of the states provided it, right? So they provide details about non-citizens enrolled in state Medicaid programs. It's actually difficult for me to tell based on the reporting, and maybe folks here know to what extent that this was just data about non-citizens in these programs, or it was everybody enrolled in Medicaid. I would hope, in some ways I have mixed feelings about both of those outcomes, right? But this is an example of, to the extent that, there may have been policies or rules internally that states weren't allowed to share them, right? They did in turn hand this over to the federal government. CMS then got ordered to turn this data over to the Department of Homeland Security. So this is where we see, actually, in some ways, I think many forms of the data protection that we would hope for kind of break down, because CMS officials explained that it violated multiple federal and statutory regulatory authorities and longstanding policy. As like Kelly said in chat, we've always done it this way. Sounds like just trust us. Well, longstanding policy, just trust us, right? That did not work. Right. And I think that the claim that this did, in fact, violate, federal statutory and regulatory authorities was correct. Right. CMS turned the data over to Homeland Security anyway. Oh, sorry. I should have switched to the slide. Anyway, so when we think about this, right, how do we think about the protections that exist for data? From a technical standpoint, whatever protections existed for this data were not against other government actors. They may have been encryption to sort of keep out outsiders, but that's not going to help if you literally turn over the data. There may be weak protections. The data may be difficult to understand or combine. But the reality is that, especially if you don't care very much about accuracy, modern kind of algorithmic tools that folks might categorize under AI can make it easier to sort of overcome those kind of weak protections. Policy protections. Well, there were agency regulations and guidance that prohibited sharing, and informal expectations and practices that prohibited sharing. Doesn't help if the people running the agency overrule. And then legal protections, right? So there were statutory provisions potentially on sharing, both under the Privacy Act, under more specific regulations that may get you a remedy after the fact, or you may be able to bring a legal challenge, but that can be really difficult to sort of put the genie back in the bottle, right? To the extent that this data is already shared, it can be really tricky to sort of be in a position where actually that's going to help very much. All right, so, well, that was super depressing. So I'm just going to make sure that we take a brief break for screaming into the void, because I think that's how I felt after I put together these slides. All right, thank you for that.
Thank you, Kendra.
But I want to talk a little bit in order to tee up Kay's presentation, where he's going to explain all the things that we can do to fix this, a little bit about what can we do. And I this is my last slide. So, I mean, of course, we can end HIV criminalization. That's obviously first on the list. But Kay will talk a little bit about working on a state level and sort of educating public health organizations. I think looking at shield law examples as a potential approach, as have happened in other bodily autonomy spaces, and then, of course, building partnerships with legal organizations to prepare for challenges. All right, that's it for me. I'll turn it over to Kay. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks so much, Kendra. Feels like we have a lot of reasons to be screaming right now. Go ahead, Ken.
Because we don't have funding for everybody, we really do ask patients to choose one program.
All right. Hi, everyone. I'm here to talk to y'all about data privacy after fumbling with my computer. So, that's always what you wanna see when someone's starting to talk to you about this stuff. Can people see my screen? Just to double check.
We can see more than just the slides. I don't know if you want to go ahead and do
Over to me.
the yeah. If you go back into your Google Slides, you could hit the slideshow, the top right, I think.
Pardon me, I think I did it out of it keeps
Oh,
shrinking me out of slideshow. I apologize.
you're fine. There we go.
Okay, so you can just see the slides now.
Are you going to go ahead and hit slideshow? There we go. We can, I can
Beautiful.
see them. Yep.
All right, I apologize. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. Okay, so my name is Kay Greenberg. My pronouns are he, him. I'm a staff attorney at the Center for HIV Law and Policy. The Center for HIV Law and Policy is an abolitionist legal and policy organization fighting to end stigma, discrimination, and violence at an intersection of HIV, race, health status, disability, class, sexuality, and gender identity expression, with a focus on criminal and public health systems. We do a lot of work with coalitions around the country to work on modernizing or their HIV laws, the HIV criminalization laws, or fighting for HIV decriminalization. And the work that I do, primarily with my colleague Amir, who I'm going to shout out, as I think he was also the one who was the model policy was his brainchild in a conversation way back when. On data privacy and bodily autonomy, and basically things that impact those that are living with or vulnerable to HIV. And that's the work that I do through CHLP. All right. So I'm here, as Kendra mentioned, I'm here to talk to you about the model policy, but I'm going to take a step back and just talk a little bit about why having this policy is important, especially in the context of a lot of the data privacy protections or lack thereof that Kendra went through. So, importantly, medical mistrust impacts health outcomes. So, how does that relate to data and data privacy? Kendra mentioned a few times molecular HIV surveillance. Michael Skiris, I know, posted some links, and there's some more links that is going to coming up that are going to give folks an introduction to that. But a very, very quick down and dirty introduction to molecular HIV surveillance is essentially when you go in to get your blood tested, and a phenotype is done to see whether or not certain antiretrovirals will be effective in treating the strain of HIV. That information, your information is quote unquote de-identified and then is sent up to the CDC where it's used for a kind of tracking and surveillance that is known as cluster detection and response. Why am I mentioning that here? Because we are aware in the world in which we live, if you're an everyday citizen, that we all have a lot of data out there that we don't have control over. And not having that control over data is linked to increasing mistrust and linked to, therefore, people disengaging from services. Conversely, there was actually the results of a study just came out that showed that actually, when people knew in the context of MHS that what was going to potentially be done with their data, that they were actually more willing to engage in treatment instead of disengaging if they found out later after the fact. So this is to point to, so control over data and control over how your data is used has a very direct correlation to people's health and people's health outcomes. Also why this we put together this model policy and why we're talking about this today is we're dealing with in a world of increased weaponization of health data. Like I mentioned, we deal with decriminalization of people living with HIV. So that is people who suffer criminal penalties that are based upon their health conditions and health status. Why do I say that health conditions and health status? Most of these statutes that we're talking about that criminalize people living with HIV don't have something that's called a mens rea, meaning that a guilty mind or conscience, meaning that you did something intentionally, trying to do something wrong, however you want to phrase that. It is just people suffer these penalties just on the basis of their health status. I believe I provided Jim with a link to CHLP's maps, and the QR code that's on the screen is if you'd like to go and check out some of more of that information. And then I pulled some stuff from around the internet that pointed to the different ways in which we were dealing with the weaponization of people's health and health status. For example, people who are seeking reproductive care, see people who are trans youth who are seeking gender affirming care. All of these things are ways in which people's health conditions and health status are now coming with criminal or civil penalties. And as HIPAA was mentioned, I like to think of HIPAA as a sieve, not as a wall, basically meaning that there's more holes in it than it's worth. These are just some of the exceptions. I'm going to highlight some of the exceptions because I pulled out the ones specifically related to dealing with government trying to get your data, trying to access your data. So law enforcement can access your health data, even if that data is covered under HIPAA, meaning that that data is held by a provider that comes under the HIPAA regulations. There's a lot of ins and outs of that. CHLP had actually done a webinar previously called What's the Hoopla About HIPAA? That has a really long, in-depth portion that was done by Chilpi out of Harvard and NASDAQ that really walks through what are protected entities, what can people get, what steps. But to summarize it, it means that law enforcement, that if a Even if an entity is covered by HIPAA, law enforcement can access that data. So, and this kind of gets into some of the ways in which law enforcement can use that data, and also some of the laws that relate to access of that data. I'm going to highlight where it talks about state laws that require testimony concerning health records and counseling. There's actually some state laws that if there's a prosecution that is occurring, that health departments are and health professionals are required to be involved. There's also a large network of laws that does deal with how what law, what hoops law enforcement may need to jump through to get your data. The reason why I say may is we're dealing with a situation where if you are a person who works at a community-based health organization or a small or as a health or part of a health department or something like that, and somebody with a badge shows up and requests data, as Kendra kind of pointed out, a lot of the ways in which there are a lot of concerns about protections of data and people are aware that they should be protecting health data from is from outside entities seeking to use it for nefarious purposes or hackers or things like that. And a lot of the people that I, in the examples I just mentioned, don't necessarily look at a police officer coming in to get someone's health information as having an underlying, quote unquote, nefarious purpose and may be actually inclined to assist in that. So even if there are rules and laws on the books that require certain steps to be taken before that officer can access your data, we're dealing in a situation where there may be people who are primed to comply with such requests. And that's just, I mean, quite frankly, based on the way in which our society primes us to interact with law enforcement, generally. Not saying that all of us believe that at this point, but we were all raised in that. I say that very particularly thinking about trying to keep my kid from watching cop-friendly shows as a 4-year-old. It's actually pretty hard. So the other thing that's important about this is that there is a this porousness is there are different guidelines and different things, and actually NASTAT has a really good interactive map if you want to see what the guidelines are in your states that refer to warrants and subpoenas and things like that. But there was the a lot of these were written without a level of specificity. What I mean, and that is important because, for example, I was a public defender at one point. I had a stack of subpoenas next to my desk that occasionally, if I needed somebody to come test to have someone come testify in court, I would fill out a subpoena and have it served on them. So that is to say that a lot of the ways in which access was given to law enforcement and to folks to get access to that data was written by folks who aren't necessarily doing the work on the ground and familiar with what the actual structures are and what the requirements and the terminologies. And all of this does feed into some of the wording and phrasing and things that were put in the model policy. I promise you, we're not just riding off on the street to a tangent. So I wanted to put this slide here. So good intentions equal problematic outcomes. Kendra kind of alluded to this at one point. When we're talking about the collection of data and we're talking about health departments collecting data, we're talking about researchers collecting data. We're typically talking about people with benevolent intent, meaning that these are people that, want to improve public health for all. These are people who want to cure diseases and do amazing things. The problem is, in the world in which we live right now, data is not neutral. And just as one can collect this data with a benevolent intent, that data can be used against a person if it is transferred or combined with another data set or all of the things that kind of the Kendra mentioned, and I was talking to with like the porousness of law enforcement. So I'm anyone who is here who is a researcher who's from the public health department, I want to challenge you to think about what you're collecting and think about whether or not you really need it and what you actually need. And for folks who are on this call who are thinking about their own data, potentially it's time to pause and think about when someone is asking you for certain information, is it information that they actually need to have? You can ask, do you need this? Do I like that you can pause and this is your health information and this is your health and safety. A lot of the issues, for example, that concern me are that is that you know like is that we are dealing with again this rush to collect data to solve these problems without putting protections in place. And I think that we really need to, in this environment, really take a moment to make sure those protections are in place before we collect the data and really also ask ourselves, what information do we actually need to accomplish the goal that we're trying to do? Are we creating, or are we just creating honeypots of data? Because, if some data is good, more data is better. All right, so why create a model policy? Well, that's kind of what I just went through. So the model policy, the purpose of it is because people should have control over their private health information to address the increased representation of health data. And to also try to limit loopholes that increase access to health data by law enforcement. And as we talked about with the issues around medical mistrust and the impact that that can have on people's engagement in care and their health outcomes, conversely, data privacy should lead to better health outcomes. It will increase that trust. It will increase people's reason to engage in care. It will increase people's reason to also share and be honest with their medical health providers to get the care that they need. So Jim is sharing on the chat a link to the model policy on data privacy. Shout out to Jim also for being a really amazing webinar organizer. Thank you so much for everything you did to bring this together. This QR code also links to where this is available on CHLP's website. All right. So a little bit of an introduction. Rather than go through the entire model policy, what I just wanted to do was just highlight a couple of important things. I'm just checking my time. All right. That I just wanted to underlay some of the purpose for why we included them and also lay the groundwork. So this is policy, not sample legislation. It is geared towards health departments, clinics, CBOs, your personal doctor, things like that. It is not written to be legislation that is passed in a state. Shout out to Kendra for walking us through the different ways protections that exist for data. It doesn't include technical protections. You'll see if you read it, there's no discussion about, air gaps between servers and the rest of the internet and things like that. Or a lot of specificity around things like cookies. It is really, in some ways, it is both a policy and also a statement of and a statement of intent. But that level of technical specification is not encompassed in it. I like to call it a choose your own adventure style. And you'll see if you look on the website that we also have it available in a Word document because not all of it is applicable in every situation and every locale and with every type of provider. So it was designed so institutions and individuals could kind of pick and choose which parts they felt that A, they wanted to implement, and B, what was even relevant to them. And it's also, again, it's designed to be used by self-advocacy, by people on one-on-one with their medical provider, and also for in larger circumstances, pushing for change. Okay. So it's a broad definition of health data because our health data is at this point larger than just our medical records, and it was trying to kind of we're trying to tr sweep a cast a wide net to try to encompass as much under this policy as possible. So also when like getting to the fact that any conversations when people are engaged in seeking information regarding a health condition, trying to kind of get beyond just the four corners of someone's health record. It requires unambiguous consent. That means that when this is implemented, people who are implemented this agree that if you're asking someone for permission on how to use their health data, having it buried in the midst of a very long privacy policy that, let's be real, nobody reads at the doctor's office. Even I do, even I don't read them, and I should know better because I'm a lawyer. In a forced click-through fashion, that those are not acceptable. That people who implement this policy are agreeing that that consent needs to be unambiguous and that people need to actually understand what they are agreeing to. Affirmatively agrees not to use for reasons other than stated or sell data to third parties. Data is big business and data is big money. And we are being tracked in ways that we are not aware of. For example, this doesn't get into technical things and technical protections, but things like people's geolocation data, meaning using being able to ping where they were on their cell phone and then linking that, for example, to places that offer abortions is the kind of data that is used against people. So even again, this is why I tried to make it. We tried to make it broader than people's health records to kind of and also added this part about not selling data to third parties because the collection of data is almost reflexive, and making an extra buck off of that data, again, with the idea of being able to use that to increase to improve services. Again, we're talking about a lot of benevolent intent is fairly common. So this is so that institutions agree to not engage in any of those practices. And again, aggregation and de-identification of data does not negate the need to get consent. So this serves a dual purpose. One, as Kendra mentioned, de-identification of data is, to a certain extent, in with today's technology, a little bit of a red herring. And also, especially when we get into the categorization of what health data is referred to, I'm not going to get too much into the weeds, but for example, data that is collected for in the course of quote unquote human subject research versus for public health purposes, there are different protections for it and there's different limitations on it. A lot of that comes from and is justified through whether or not that data is de-identified, and this policy challenges you to really authoritatively engage, like not authoritatively, but to engage in best practices when it comes to informed consent, and that includes for data that will be used in a way in which it is de-identified. And again, this purpose is also to improve that trust so people's information isn't being used without their consent, regardless of whether or not their name is actually attached to it. I'm going to stop sharing after I leave this up for 2 seconds. If you want to get more information about what we're up to at CHLP or the Positive Justice Project, the decriminalization work that is done by my really awesome colleagues, I invite you all to sign up for our list.
Wow. Thank you, Kay. We have heard a lot of information, and I am flustered for a number of reasons, but I also appreciate, the two lenses, right? Like, we need to understand how porous, how accessible, some of this data is. We need to understand how it's being used. We need to understand, is there really a need for it? And as you were, speaking, Kay, I kept thinking of the context of where I work, which is in a research, facility. They've been collecting data on people living with HIV for 30 and 40 years. And then, of course, there's some tools that we had. Kendra, you shared some tools. And then we have the amazing policy template that I actually think is, could be absolutely applicable globally. So a lot of information, and I'm glad what these slides are going to be shared. I'm glad some of these links are being shared, but I wanted to get to some questions as well. And so I'll start us off as I look. I know there were several questions in the chat, but and maybe both of you can answer this, but what are some of the data collection and storage practices occurring right now that are of particular concern? So I know that you shared generally, especially with what's going on, potentially what could go on with Medicaid, SNAP, and so on. But could you maybe specify just a few of the specific data collection and storage practices so that folks can be aware?
Kay, do you want to go first? Do you want me to go first? I mean, I think one thing I will say, and I think it's it's hard because I think this all exists in a rapidly changing risk model, right? For individuals and for folks collectively. I think one thing that I would say is that is challenging about like testing data of the type that's reported to the CDC under the sort of surveillance system is that it's a mandatory requirement to send it, right? And one of the things that we saw in the Medicaid data case involving potentially undocumented or non-citizen Medicaid folks is that there were states that actually just like didn't send the data, right? So there were a couple of states that had sent the data to the federal government, and then there were states that hadn't done it yet or hadn't done it, period, right? And those states did not, the folks who lived in those states did not have their information shared with the Department of Homeland Security. And so I think that any form, when we're thinking about kind of risk, any form of data that is directly and required to be shared with the federal government right now, because of the sort of degree to which it's not clear that federal government agencies are able to actually meaningfully follow their legal and policy commitments to people, both, with regards to how that data is supposed to be used. For example, like the CDC data, right? It's supposed to be used for research, for health. But like when we look at the context of the Medicaid data, we can see that, those guarantees didn't necessarily stop DHS from having access to it. So I think, my kind of general answer is that in the current environment in the US with the federal government, data that is sort of required to automatically be passed on to the federal government is stuff that I would think of as especially risky. And I think it maybe speaks to kind of thinking a little bit about the degree to which local state governments are thinking more carefully about how they want to address or in conjunction with the model policy, how they want to navigate those situations with, because I think on some level the types of guarantees that folks have historically made with regards to sort of how that data will be used are not holding up particularly well. That's my thought, but I'm sure Kay has more specifics.
Yes. And Kay, if you could also add, maybe a context of how you can stretch this globally as well, if you can. But yeah, please go ahead and respond.
I wish I could. I
Perfect.
guess the only thing I can say globally, and in some ways, I think I think in some ways it's also what we can learn, what the US can learn from globally. I think I talked about this in like another context. So like looking at I've heard people who are health workers in Uganda and stuff talking about essentially how to work with folks who are living with HIV when HIV is connected to, at least in people's minds, to homosexuality in a country where homosexuality is criminalized, and the ways in which they've looked at their record keeping and what they write down and what they put down to make sure that they are providing the utmost protections for the people who are coming to them for care. So I guess honestly, the way I can think about expanding it globally is more like, hey, US, you got some folks out there that you can maybe learn from who have already been doing this work on the ground. That was my quick pivot. I guess because I think it's also like I'm, everyone saw me struggle with the computer. I'm not a technology person. I'm a Luddite. I like books and paper and things like that. So I'm not the person who you're going to want to talk to about your very specific like data protections and things like that. But I think it's more when we are gathering data that there really more thought needs to be put into the purpose of the data and making sure that that limitations are put into place and that they are firm limitations. And honestly, about not using the criminal system as a way of providing as a way of dealing with people's health and healthcare, because another
Exactly.
situation talking about is the PDMPs are prescription drug monitoring programs. I'm bad with an acronym, so I made sure to write down what that stood for, which are basically it's something that was used more and more because of the opioid crisis to get to both identify folks who were using medication, using prescription medications, and to quote unquote get them into help or not feed their addiction, quote unquote. I'm using, or conversely, to try to identify actors who are acting as pill farms, so basically doctors who are writing prescriptions to anyone who came through their door. And it was like, okay, we have this problem with this opioid crisis. Let's monitor all of this stuff so the police can have a very, very, very easy way. Like this one article that talks about PDMPs is like that the officers, when they're bored, go online and look at PDMP information. I don't know why, but apparently that's what that office does. So it's very accessible to law enforcement, and let's give them access to this information in a way of helping and protecting people. But in the end, again, you're creating, first of all, you're criminalizing people on the basis of substance use disorders and health conditions. And second of all, this is something that's expanded. Testosterone is on PDMPs. And we're talking about a world in which people are being criminalized on the basis of their gender identity and the medical treatment that they decide to engage in. On the basis of their gender identity. So we've created this easy, and it's very easy to add different medications and things to these PDMPs. So to a certain extent, we've created the problem, but it's an example of, again, something in which it would had a quote unquote benevolent use in which that data is being used very negatively. So let's not work with law enforcement
Yeah,
to
at all.
solve health conditions.
Period. There's a couple related questions in the chat, and one of them has to do with data brokers. I guess there's sort of middlemen to brokers, I mean to data. So data brokers, are they also covered by HIPAA protections? And I know that I see you shaking your head already. And there was another question, and maybe you could expand a little bit on that, but there was another question about how long the medical information is kept. So somebody in the chat compared it to tax information that it's supposed to be kept. There's a time frame, perhaps, 3 years, 7 years, I don't know. But is there a time frame to which medical information is kept, or it can go, it can be accessed from far back? So maybe just, I know you already shook your heads, but if you could say a little bit about that.
Yeah, I can talk. I'll talk. I'm happy to take a first crack at the data brokers question. So the reason Kay and I are shaking our heads is no. Generally, data brokers are not subject to HIPAA. It is true that like your medical provider is really not supposed to sell your EHR record to a data broker, right? Like, HIPAA doesn't do a lot of things very well, but like theoretically, at least, it should keep you from doing that. However, the reality is that oftentimes, even in the context of getting medical care, there's all kinds of other information that's gathered about folks that isn't contained within their formal medical records, right? So, thinking about things like, tracking information for website visits for healthcare providers, and that can be sold to you or shared with data brokers, which are basically just third parties that buy or gather data from sort of other organizations and kind of package it sometimes in new formats and sell it. Data brokers, I think, represent a really significant, I mean, it's why the US having a lack of actual meaningful federal privacy regulation is a problem, turns out. And there have been efforts to crack down on them. There was FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, so the U.S. primary like federal consumer protection agency, was sort of trying to do some of that stuff under the Biden administration. But one of the realistic problems is that health data, the term health data as it's sort of imagined by HIPAA really applies when we're thinking about what basically what happens in the doctor's office. But of course, as Kay and I both talked about, there's sort of all kinds of other data that happens that can reveal information about health status or has implications for someone's health, and that stuff can often be freely sold. Different states have different levels of protection. For example, California has much more significant protection against certain kinds of information sharing and the ability to delete one's information. But just in the US on a federal level, like you often don't have a lot of fantastic responses to sort of data brokers. And it
Right.
does get used by law
Okay.
enforcement. Sorry, that was my one other thing I will say, you know, that we have clear examples of information from data brokers being used by law enforcement as part of criminal investigations.
Gotcha. And thank you. We have a question from Melanie. Melanie, thanks for putting it in the chat. I wasn't ignoring you. but it's about Doge, accessing all this data that was, given in relation to benefits. And I know that you all even addressed earlier some of the data that was being used to identify immigrants accessing healthcare. But what are they doing with this information?
Melanie, I wish I had an answer for you. I mean, that's part of the problem is that there's a lot of stuff that is happening and we don't know how it's being used yet. And part of the issue with the way that the laws work, like some I feel like a question that comes up relatedly to what you're asking is, well, what can we do to stop them? Can't we sue them? Can't we do this? And the ways in which most of the laws that all of the suits that Kendra mentioned is you need to be able to show harm first. And that's harm as defined under the law, not as harm as like you and I may believe that. I even have. Shout out to the model policy. I have a definition of harm at the bottom to that the sharing of someone's data in and of itself is harm because of that. So not only do we not know what they're doing with it, we don't really have a real way of finding it out.
Oh, wow.
Which
Two
is
quick additions there. Sorry, Kate. I didn't.
no.
Yeah. So I mean, I think I second what Kate said is we don't totally know, right? Like, you know, I think some of that stuff definitely is getting used to sort of theoretically identify like fraud or waste, right? And I think, you know, that you know, that doesn't mean that it's not getting used for other things, right? And I think what we've seen is sort of the widespread rollout of like AI tools, which I think frankly provides cover for the kinds of political actions that Doge wants to take, right? So I think it's best to think of AI here as not a technical tool, but sort of a political one to say, hey,
Political
I want
tool.
something to come, an algorithm to come in and say, I can do this, I get to do this thing, right? But I think the other thing, the thing I would say in the context of the lawsuits, which I think Kay is totally right to flag that like state, showing harm is an issue, is, you know, one thing that many of the lawsuits that I was talking about pretty much all are based on the Privacy Act, which is, you know, re regulates the actions of the federal government. And the Privacy Act has rules about what you're supposed to do and make public about kind of data systems and data storage at the federal government level. And so I think that part of what's hard is that that stuff is like, you know, pardon the phrase, deeply unsexy, right? Like, you know, I will admit, like, I do a lot of work in the general space of sort of privacy and computer security. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about the Privacy Act, or at least I didn't before this, because it often wasn't necessarily super relevant. You know, the federal government putting out notices about what they were doing surveillance-wise was not necessarily always super helpful. But I think one of the things that it does give us, and one of the things that Doge, to the extent that much of this litigation is focused on trying to make them follow the rules, we may actually get more information about how these systems are being used because many of those rules have to do with disclosing that information, even if we
Right.
can't necessarily stop it. And that is helpful to sort of understand what the risks profile and like what's actually happening.
Kendra, maybe I'll add to that. There was an additional question in the chat about Palantir. I'm not sure who this is. They've been contracted to amass all this information. And do we know anything about them? I think it's kind of connected. And then I'll bundle up a couple other questions that have been asked for both you. Okay.
So Palantir is a tech company. They've been around for a long time. They're named after the all-seeing eye of Sauron in Lord of the Rings. I wish I was kidding. It's true. And sort of, yeah, folks in chat are, you know, have expressed concerns about Palantir, which is fair. So, you know, I think part of what's hard here is the degree to which one of the things we don't know about Doge is to what extent either, they are sharing this information with private entities. And in the case of Palantir, it's actually more clear that that's what's happening. And, in those circumstances, we lose a lot of the tools that we might actually have to regulate the federal government's usage of data, right? Because, private companies are less accountable. They oftentimes, the reason one might contract with a private company to do certain forms of surveillance is one doesn't think that one can do it within the federal government apparatus. So Palantir is really terrible. And they do use, I think, when I talked about like sort of weak technological barriers, right? The fact that it's hard to correlate certain types of data and sort of match across data sets, that's the kinds of things that Palantir sells, right? Is tooling to make it easier to sort of correlate data sets to understand the data that you have. And that's why it's concerning when we see sort of the contracts with Palantir. Yeah, I can see folks in chat are talking about whether they're subject to like freedom of information, right? Which is to say that's another problem with, private entities is you can't use many of the transparency tools you would use in other contexts.
In other contexts. Well, and there's a related question to that, but sort of keeping in line with what we're just talking about, there's this idea, and I think Nana put this in the chat, related to the idea that they're going to use Medicaid data to share, for use for detentions and deportations in blue states. That, we're anticipating that they're going to do that. We can imagine that they're going to do. We don't have to have a wild imagination to know that they're going to do that. But in relation to that, what can folks do? I think it's what are some of the ways for us to be more useful to policy and legal efforts around data privacy? Also, any advice, thoughts around how we can document support for gender-affirming medical care during this time? So just folks are looking for practical ways to support some of these, even if you've said they're kind of unknown, we don't know, but what can we do?
Well, okay, do you want to talk? I mean, we've talked about the model policy. I think,
Some other policy.
I think one thing that actually I think is really important when we're talking about folks living with HIV or generally any populations where folks have been historically criminalized, right? And currently criminalized is one of the things that I saw as someone who often works in contexts where folks are not centering those who are criminalized. Is sort of after the Dobbs decision, this sort of recognition that the tools of the surveillance state and of criminalization could get turned on populations that folks did not think should be subject to that criminalization. In this case, like sort of white, upper middle class women who were getting abortions, right? Is the sort of what I saw. And I do think that that changes that understanding of who is subject to criminalization, I think changes how folks engage with this data collection. And so I think in terms of thinking about what folks can do, I think this is a moment to advocate to people who may not have been receptive previously because they did see exactly what Kay said, right? Like, they're thinking of all of the good things that can come with this data and they don't want to think about the risks. That, this advocacy is actually easier in this moment because the risks are clearer and right there and it's harder to hide. And that folks who are criminalized, who are working with folks who are criminalized, are able to actually really talk about what that looks like in a way that may be harder in other contexts. So yeah, I think like I do think it creates a moment for that. Kay, I don't know if you have other thoughts.
I think I mean, I think you put that part really well. And I think one of the other things that folks can do, and it came up, like, for example, in the Medicaid context, is avoid any kind of preemptive compliance. Now, we've talked about preemptive compliance with, like, in this case, turning over Medicaid records, or universities stopping the whatever, like, there's been various forms in which that comes up, but and kind of in almost like this, like, larger macro levels. But on these micro levels, preemptive compliance is, and this is, actually, I'd say is probably the bulk of the text of the model policy, is
Model
essentially
policy.
agreeing to fight these things and fight them tooth and nail, because at least A, you can slow down what is happening, or B, you will find out again, because a lot of times, for example, when law enforcement is trying to access stuff, they are relying on the fact that a badge carries with it a certain level of
Security.
threat and a certain level of people will comply along with that, assuming that they are acting for things lawfully. Nothing says that the police have to actually ask for things lawfully. The limitations come of whether or not they can use stuff in court, depending upon how it's been gotten, dot, 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 dot. But if they go to a and ask for something in a state in which a warrant is required and it's turned over without a warrant, that's not a violation of the Fourth Amendment. That can be used in court. So this is just all to say, and nothing, and no one's going to censure the police for going and asking for something and not getting a warrant first. So this is all to say that in setting up all of these, in when you're looking to collect data, thinking about writ large who may want to access it and what stop gaps and what limitations you could put on access of that data, and make accessing that data as damn difficult as possible. And this may mean, again, some sacrifices, like, there's a lot of discussion about in like the ideas of like interoperability and getting people's health records to work across states and getting health departments to transfer information across states. Again, with benevolent intent,
Coming to
we need to
but
pause and think about that.
and yeah. And I see this discussion, and so this is me taking, moderator mic privilege. Just, you've been talking about the folks that collect data, and I feel like I wish they could be an audience just for them, because I mean, even just looking at the chat, a lot of the folks I know collecting data, public health data, are not here. And then there's this flip side where there's us. There was a question in the chat about how do we educate policymakers, right, to divest from, being surveillance states and stuff like that. Well, first of all, I want to get this model policy into as many people's hands as possible, because as an HIV community, we're very good at standing on tables and screaming, and sometimes that works. And sometimes it's important for us to have this language and to really understand what we're up against. And there's never been a moment such as now where we need to understand what we're up against in terms of policy when we're talking to lawmakers, but also in terms of fighting, for our rights, resisting, we've t even building coalitions. We now know that Medicaid is going to impact more people than just people living with HIV. So this is a time to break barriers and silos and work with folks, to really understand what we're up against in losing our health care. But we've also talked on other, in other platforms about building tents, understanding how we are to advocate for each other, fight for each other, like you're saying, Kay. Police officers come into your neighborhood and start asking, and knocking on people's doors. We need to understand what our role is and what we can do in order to protect each other. So there's so much going on and so much to understand, but I really want folks to be able to leave with, you have this template policy in your hands. What are the ways we can adapt it and use it? Think of, my other hat that I wear is People Living with HIV Caucus, right? They are AIDS service organizations, and then they're just advocacy organizations. Just give us sort of a little highlight of what we can do with this policy and how we can use it if we walk into a policy, actual policymaker's office.
I mean, I think honestly, so I'm just going to pause on what you said, kind of a policymaker's office. And that's the goal in creating this is that there's no policymakers are needed. This is something that you can talk to your doctor about. And a lot of I have found in having conversations with, quite frankly, my own medical professionals and things like that, a lot of them are not aware of things and are shocked and horrified by a lot of the information you pass along to them. Because again, when you're talking to someone like your doctor, you're not talking to someone who really saw themselves as a, member of the surveillance state who's setting the people up that they provide medical care of for risk. They are trying to provide medical care and help people and save lives and whatever reason they went to medical school for. So I think it's so I think it doesn't need to be, it's not necessarily as daunting as policymakers. Obviously it's created so it can be adapted by larger institutions, but it's hopefully something that can be used in a one-on-one conversation with your medical provider so they can make sure that they can put in what protections they can. And just kind of keep people aware. And that's, and also like, I appreciate how much love the model policy is getting, but I also want to shout out, like, this is why it's important to have folks like Kendra involved also, because all of this stuff is created, the law is basically created so nobody understands it. We freaking use Latin on a regular basis, i.e. I talked had to talk about med rea to talk about something in the law. It is opaque. It is not understandable. So it's also important to have all of this be translated so people understand what's going on.
What's
So
going on?
shout out to Kendra for coming and being a part of this too.
Thank you so much, y'all. I'm going to hand over to Jim here in a minute, but we've heard it. I am going to take a look at this because I'm in that environment. But what I'm understanding is that this is something we can all use in medical settings research. We're the most like over-researched population. Let's take this to where it can be used by folks who don't understand that they're doing a benevolence, a good thing for us, but what the information they're collecting can be used in different ways, and we need to make them understand that. So amazing. Thank you so much, Kendra. Thank you so much, Kay. We're right on top of the hour here. Let me hand over to Jim.
So I want to ex also extend my thanks to, and I want to see everyone give love in the chat and with your emojis to our wonderful moderator, Martha, and our two excellent, excellent expert speakers, Kendra and Kay. And thank you to all of you in the chat who have made this so robust and so interesting and so much great discussion. I know, like many of you, it's easy to feel overwhelmed. I feel completely overwhelmed every single day, multiple times a day. But I think one of the things, and this feels very overwhelming, but I know with folks in this room, the experts who led this chat, and us as a community, if we stand in solidarity and resist, we can stop this regime. And that's what we have to do. We have to end this regime. We can't just change a policy or a law. Because this regime does not care about policies or laws or rules or the Constitution. So with that said, we have recorded this Zoom. It will be shared with you. The recording will be shared with you. The slides will be shared with you in a resource document with all the great links that you all have added into the chat. You'll get an email follow-up in about a day with all that information and the link to get all this stuff. So please check that out. And I hope to see you on our next webinar next week, which is focusing on task shifting in the era of long-acting injectable prep and how we can do better by being more creative in how we deliver our services. We can have great modalities that work wonderful, but they don't mean anything and don't do anything if they sit on the shelf. And we make it very hard for both clinics and people to get these things. So please join us for that. Thanks again to all of our speakers. Thank you all for being here and sharing your morning with us. There's always lots of news. I'm sure there will be news that we will all be consuming as soon as we step out of this webinar. So hang in there and just remember community solidarity. We are not alone. There's way more of us than, quote, them, and we can beat this. So with that, have a
Yes, we
wonderful
can.
day, evening, tomorrow, whatever the case may be. Ciao, Bellas.
Thank you all so much.